So lecture three will be about scattering equations and amplitudes. So this is what, as I promised, the new way of writing down at least the tree level scattering amplitudes of various theories with massless particles. And the key to this new formulation is the equations we introduced yesterday, so-called scattering equations. So the lesson we learned from yesterday, let me just briefly review here. It's basically the following statement. If we have n complex variables z1, z2, to zn, that satisfy some equation. Of this form. Let's give a name to this guy called EA for the A's equation. A runs from 1 to n. And let me remind you, this SAB is the Mandelstam variable of external particles. So SAB is just Ka plus Kb of the momentum, and in the massless case, it's just 2Ka dot Kb, okay? So if you have a set of complex variables satisfy this equation, then we conclude that this function z of, so for any permutation, omega, this function, this so-called Park-Taylor factor, will satisfy U1 decoupling identity and also BCJ identity. Okay, so actually you can put, it can be much more general. You can put any function of Z here as long as it's a permutation invariant function. So it doesn't depend on the omega you put for your external labels. So this function should be invariant and under permutation. So once you find a bunch of Z's that satisfy this equation, all the EA equals zero, then what I showed you yesterday is that this kind of object will satisfy BCG relations. Yes? Sorry? Oh, yes. Very good. So yesterday I write down the equation for this one, E1, which is S1B over Z1 minus ZB. So that's why it's B from 2 to N. But that's only for the BCG relation with particle 1. So now, actually, it can be repeated for any particle. So for any A, you have such an equation that as long as B different from A, it should hold. Yeah, thanks. So yesterday, we already found a special solution in 4D. So in 4D, we say that if you have a bunch of spinners for the particles, and each of them look like this, you can rescale the first component to be 1. And this is the inhomogeneous coordinate on the Riemann sphere. So this n spinners can be viewed as n punctures on the sphere. Then this is already a special solution to this equation, which is basically follow from momentum conservation. But this is very special. This is just in 4D. And in that case, this function is the Park-Taylor formula for MHV scattering of gluons, right? But now we are talking about some statement that is very general. I can give you any solution to this equation. So you can imagine that there are already in 4D, there are more solutions than that. But this is just a special solution. But in general dimension, you cannot even talk about the spinners and so on, right? So any complex variable satisfy this equation that can be written down in any dimension, this function will do the job. So this will be our starting point. We want to write down some function with Park-Taylor with any permutation invariant object subject to the set of equations, and then it will be used to construct Yang-Mills amplitude. Yes.
So in the special case of four dimensions,
yes.
Take a concrete example. So if we complexify the momenta, mm-hmm. lambda and lambda tilde are unrelated.
They are independent. Yeah.
Right. So these equations are for only the z's or the z tildes or.
So this is one special solution. There's another special solution that you choose your z's or z tilde if you want. I mean. This I call the solution one, this is called the solution two. This is another special solution. So this is usually called MHV solution, solution one, and this is called MHV bar solution. So in four dimension, actually what our argument yesterday based on momentum conservation gives you two special solutions. So remember, when I write this, I'm solving Z in terms of external data. So I give you a bunch of lambda and I rescale them to get all these Z's. This works as a solution that gives you Park-Taylor formula for MHV amplitude, and this won't give you the MHV bar. They are independent for a complex moment. But these are all special. These are just two of the general solutions that we'll discuss now, okay?
And how are the SAVs specified with just Z's? SAV requires both the lambdas and
yes.
the lambda tilde,
yes.
right?
Yes.
So do you use the same Z's for both in?
Oh, no. So in 4D, SAB is just written as AB and times AB, right? So what we mean by this solution is that it is only a function of lambda. And this solution is only a function of lambda tilde. But in general, they are function of both. They are function of this SAB. So these are just special case. So now you should really view this. You should forget about the spinner helicity in general dimension that you just, I give you a bunch of data that's this Lorentz contraction of external momenta, and I want to solve some, I want to find some complex variable that satisfy this equation, okay? So it just happens that you have this magical variable to factorize them, and then two of the solution just only depend on holomorphic and anti-holomorphic part of the kinematics. But in general, that's not the case. This is a very special case. It's just a model I showed you yesterday that once you have this solution, then this reduced to the Park-Taylor formula in 4D. Okay. So let's now take these equations very seriously. So this is the so-called scattering equations that we believe is underlying all the massless scattering at tree level, at least, in arbitrary dimension. So forget about this 4D special case. This is just a serve as a motivation that there is such solutions and they are closely related to the Park-Taylor formula. Now we want to study this equation seriously, okay? So the first part of today's lecture is want to explain to you some properties of this equation. They look very, very simple. I mean, they're just n equations for this n complex variables, but actually they are very hard to solve and there are many interesting properties of this, okay? So the first, as I just mentioned, this is a this equation is the following, that you provide me some data, which is this set of Mandelstam variable SAB. And through this equation, I can find some solutions that's given by Z1, Z2, to Zn. So there are more than one solutions in general, right? At least in 4D case, you already see there are generally two solutions. So there are many solutions that for this. So let's let's study what is this. This is the so-called space of kinematic invariants, right? So they are the Lorentz invariants formed from your external momenta. And let's give a name to it. It's just Kn for m particle, for m massless particle. So this is actually a map from any point in Kn, which is specified by a bunch of Mandelstam, to a point in this moduli space of n punctured spheres. Let's also give it a name. So the moduli space of n punctured spheres. I think I already explained why this is a sphere. You can use the projection from this point to any point on the sphere to here, so you can relate it to a complex variable in your complex plane, including the infinity point, which is this point. Okay, so this indeed parametrizes the sphere with n puncture and the moduli space of them, meaning all possible values of this z's. Let's give it a name, which is m n zero, where the zero is, means it's a genus zero Riemann surfaces. It doesn't matter. Just this is a map that I give you the kinematics. You want to solve it to find maybe not just one point, but maybe more than one, multiple points on this, because it's a not a one-to-one map. You will find more than one solution, okay? And the second property that's has something to do with this sphere is that there are redundancy to the system, okay? So this is something I already mentioned yesterday. There's this SL2C redundancy. That's basically a conformal symmetry of your sphere. So there's a this symmetry acts like the following. If you give me a ZA for all the A's, it's a global symmetry. It maps ZA to alpha plus beta ZA over, say, gamma plus delta ZA, which is a Möbius transformation that satisfies this determinant equals one. So the sphere is invariant under such a transformation. This is a symmetry acting on a sphere. So actually, any point, this space is defined as a collection of all such n points modular that redundancy, right? So we have to take into account this redundancy. What does it mean in practice is that there aren't n independent variables, only n minus three of them. So you can use this redundancy. This can be used to fix three variables for you, three z's. For example, we can choose randomly z1, z2, z3 can be fixed at some given value. For example, 0, 1, and infinity. That would be one way to fix it. We put z0 here, z1 here equals 0, and z2 here equals 1, and z3 here equals infinity. That's just one way to fix it. You can choose any value to fix three of the variables. But this redundancy also exists for the equations, okay? So this is a non-trivial part. So I hope this part is very clear, that you have, say, on the sphere, you have translation, rotation, dilation, and so on. So you can generate this transformation, and you can use it to fix three degree of freedom. Now, the equation also has this degree of freedom, this redundancy. That is quite non-trivial. So I'll leave this as an exercise to show that the equation actually are not independent, this n equations. Remember, this is the n equations we discussed here, e1 through en. So if you take the sum of them, it's actually zero. And if you take the sum of them with za multiply for each of them, also with za square, these are all zero. So this is an exercise that you will need to use momentum conservation. And in this case, it's simply SAB summing over B equals zero. So use this to prove that there are three relations among the equations. Yes. Map the points to what?
On the plane.
Yes. No. You identify infinity as one point on the sphere. So there aren't many points. Sorry? Yes. Yes. No, that's the definition of your Riemann sphere. You make the complex plane and you identify all the points at infinity as a single point, which is this north pole in our case. Okay, and this is three redundancy that's exactly given by this SL2C, because the infinitesimal generator of this, so the infinitesimal generator of this is the following. You shift the ZA by, say, alpha prime plus beta prime ZA plus gamma prime ZA square. So these are three, this is one. These are three null vector of your SL2C generator. And turns out that the equation has these three relations that you can show. So in other words, here we say there are only n minus three independent variables, and there are also only n minus three independent equations. So this is actually a system of n minus three equations for n minus three variables. So you can use the SL2C to fix 3 points and also eliminate any three equations you want. That's your starting point to solve such equations, okay? And I can also write down the transformation of EA under a finite transformation, okay? So under this transformation, EA just goes to this, let's see, A from 1 to n, gamma plus delta ZA times EA. Oh, sorry, it's just each of them. So this will go like square. If I get it correctly. Minus two, sorry. Okay. So you can also check this. If you do the transformation with your ZA, with all the Zs in your equation, then each EA transform covariantly under this SL2C transformation. This is equivalent to this condition that there are three relations among. Yes.
Sorry, I think I already missed something broad.
Yeah.
What is this SL2C, or like which symmetry do we have here?
It's just this sphere that when I give you n punctures on this sphere, mm-hmm. actually you can do a transformation, you know, like rotating these points or translate them on this sphere such that the configuration doesn't actually change under this transformation. So if I give you n distinct z's mm-hmm. and another set of n z's, if they're related by this, then they are the same points in this moduli space. So this is an equivalence relation on this moduli space. So this is defined as collection of all such z's moduli this condition.
And is it obvious that SLPC is a symmetry or is the redundancy in this?
So it's actually the point that you want to use a sphere rather than say n points on a complex plane to describe this system. So actually, if you are considering some massive particle scattering, you won't want this SL2C and so on. So this is a special case, as I'll explain in the next property, which is this moduli space MN0 with this redundancy is precisely what you need to describe massless particle scattering. So this is actually something we know, not ahead of time. You have to consider that you are using this auxiliary space to describe some massless particle scattering, and since you are since this space with the redundancy will be able to do that, that's why you choose this. Okay, so if you don't put SL2C here, then you have some problem. Your equation it won't be suitable for describing the massless particle scattering. Not just Lorentz symmetry. So
it's actually conformal symmetry in the two dimensional plane.
It is a conformal symmetry, but yeah, I guess the question is why do you need such a conformal symmetry? And I think it lies closely with the fact that you're describing massless particle scattering. Yeah, I'll come to this point in a few minutes.
So what is the last line you wrote there?
Oh yeah, so this is under ZA transform like this. Yeah, actually, we can show this, right? Yeah, I don't.
Probably. What is SLPC equivalent to that transformation?
This is the Möbius transformation. So if you have a matrix alpha, beta, gamma, delta, acting on this coordinate 1, ZA, right? Then what you get is, say, 1 and that guy. I call it ZA prime. So this is the transformation acting on your sphere with the inhomogeneous coordinate. Yes. And it doesn't really matter a lot what precise form you write it. The key thing is that since there's this redundancy that we'll see very soon that is crucial for our description, you only need n minus three variables and n minus three equations. Okay? So the next property, the third one. So the second one is the redundancy, which is trivial on the variables and slightly non-trivial, you need to show it for your equations. And the third one is that exactly because of this redundancy, the equation has something very nice to do. So the equations, they map singularities of your kn to the singularities of the moduli space. So this is a very non-trivial property that only for massless particle scattering and only if you're using this Riemann sphere with redundancy that will work. So what is the singularities of kn? This is exactly the physical singularities of your tree level scattering. So in other words, you study some massless particle scattering. When a subset of the momentum become own shell, this is corresponding to a factorization. And that's the singularity I'm talking about. So for each singularity in your space of kinematic invariance, through the equation, you will find that it corresponds to, it is a one-to-one correspondence. It corresponds to one singularity of your moduli space of the Z's. So let me give you an example for 4 point, okay? So what is the Kn space here? I think I've told you last time that for 4 point case, we can even write S equals S1, 2, and 3, 4. T equals S1, 4, and S2, 3. And U equals S1, 3, S2, 4, with S plus T plus U equals 0, right? So this is just the convention we're using. So now let's look at this space of all this S, T, and U. It's actually a two-dimensional space because of that constraint. So this is the, say, let's call this line the line of T equals 0, which is the S axis. And this line, the line of S equals 0, is the T axis. And then you have another line, which is U equals 0. Or it's just T plus S equals 0, right, on this ST plane. So this is the space of K4, the kinematic space of four massless particles, right? And these are the three singularities of the space. You have either S channel, T channel, or U channel. Your tree level amplitude should factorize on this three singularity. Now I want to show you that through our equation, this maps to the exactly the three singularities of your M40. So the moduli space of four punctured spheres under this SL2C redundancy. I mean, modular this SL2C redundancy. So this space is actually well known. It's a complex dimension one space that I can draw like a sphere or something, roughly like a sphere. But it has three singularities that I'll explain now. So this roughly looks like this. It's a complex dimension one or real dimension two space that has three tails of these singularities. And every point here corresponding to a sphere with four punctures, modular SL2C. So what is this point? This point just corresponding to a sphere that I have, say, Z1 here at zero, Z2 here at one, Z3 here at infinity. So I already fixed the gauge, okay? The gauge I choose there. Z1, Z2, Z3 is fixed to be this three. And now Z4, where is Z4? Because it's an arbitrary point on this moduli space, Z4 can lie happily here or there, anywhere. So this is just a generic point. So let me just clarify that. You have a sphere with four punctures and three of them are fixed. So only one of them are allowed to run. And this corresponding to different points on your moduli space. So every point here is a sphere. Now, what is this three special points? That's the so-called singularity of your moduli space. It's exactly when your Z4 start to coincide with Z1, Z2, or Z3, right? So these are the singularities. So for example, we can give it a name that this point corresponding to a sphere that Z4 goes to infinity. And this point corresponding to the okay, so there are also three singular spheres that your Z4 starts to coincide with Z1 or Z2 or Z3. So this is, I hope it's clear that this is the moduli space of four punctures because you can fix three, so it's one dimensional, one complex dimension. And now the point is that our equation will exactly bring this three singularity to this three singularity. Let's see it now. Yes.
Shouldn't the zero be at the top four?
No. You just project it down to this zero here, right? This one here and infinities.
But you need points to be on the Riemann sphere, right?
Oh yes, you're right. Sorry, what am I drawing here? How should I put it on this? Sorry, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
And do the kinematic invariants need to be real?
No. They are complex in general. So you just fix three points and Z4 can run everywhere. And whenever you hit this, the solution to our equation will tell you that you hit some singularity here. Yes, sorry.
What do you mean by that? Yeah, every point in this spiky space.
Sorry, every point?
At every point in this spiky thing that you drew in the middle there. You said there's a sphere.
Oh, yes. So this is the moduli space of punctures here. So every point of your space represents a sphere with four punctures. Yes. But this is a different space than the sphere itself. So it's just a collection of all the spheres. That's why we call it modular space. And now let's write down the equation for four point, okay? So as I told you, there are three redundancies. So you can, yes. It doesn't really matter. It's just a real dimension two space with three singularities. So that's just an illustration of it. Just forgive my drawing. Yeah. And I'm just trying to make sure that all these points are, you know, like very generic, and these are three spikes. Yes. Okay. So the equation is the following. You have E1, E2, E3, E4. We can eliminate any three of them. So let's just look at E1. And E1 is the following. Right, this is our equation. But remember, we have already fixed 1, 2, 3 to be 0, 1, infinity. So this is just 1. This is infinity, so this term drop. And this is just a Z4. Okay? So what is this equation equals 0 mean? What does E1 equals 0 mean? It means Z4 is actually minus S14 over S12, or in our language, minus T over S. So this is the solution to our equation. This form doesn't really matter. This is just a why T and S appear here with a minus sign is because I fixed this gauge to be, I choose this special SL2C fixing. It can be rewritten in terms of cross ratio and so on. It doesn't really matter. But now in any gauge fixing, we should see the property that this solution will map the singularity of my tree level scattering for four massless particle to this sphere. So let's plug it in here. That Z4 will be minus T over S. Sorry. So if you look at S equals 0, it means Z4 will become infinity, right? So this singularity is indeed mapped there. This singularity. And if you look at T equals 0, it means Z4 is 0. So it's mapped to here. And if you look at U equals 0, it means T is minus S. So Z4 is mapped to 1. This is just a very, if you're familiar with string theory, this is not very surprising, but it's just a few theory level, there's also such a correspondence that the singularity of your moduli space is describing the singularity of your physics scattering. Okay, so this is an example, and it's actually generalized to n point. Which is also answer the question why we use this Riemann sphere with this SL2C symmetry. So for n point scattering, you can write down your Kn space with all these singularities, and they are in one-to-one correspondence with the moduli space if you write down the solution to your equation. However, in that case, it's much more complicated, which brought us to the next point of the properties of this equation, point 4. which is that the number of solutions is n minus 3 factorial. So this number has appeared many times, this counting. But I won't explain this. I may prove this tomorrow when I discuss about soft theorem and so on. But you just need to know that these equations are not easy to solve. So there are some polynomial equations for your z's once you eliminate all the denominators. So at 4 point, I've shown you that this is very easy. It's a linear equation with one solution. But already at 5 point, I'll also leave this as an exercise. Try to show that for n equals 5, this is a quadratic equation with two solutions. Okay, so for 5 point, it will be two solutions, and for 6 point, it's already six solutions and so on. So in practice, it's still an important question how to find a closed form solutions to scattering equations to all multiplicity. It's very difficult. In practice, what we do is we just solve them numerically. If you hand me 10 particle kinematics, you can just solve them, find all the solutions, and then you compute the amplitude using these solutions, as I'll explain now. But as a mathematical question, it's actually still quite difficult to find all the solutions analytically. But this is a property I want to mention about these equations. Okay. So there's a last one. So all this is just about solving the equation, but why do we want to solve them? Because as I said, this equation, the solutions of this equation encode the singularity structure of your tree amplitude. So we want to use it to give you some closed formula for any tree level scattering. For example, for young mu's, we want to write down something like this, where your z's satisfy the scattering equations, such that this kind of formula will give you the young mu's amplitude in the end. Of course, with an appropriate f that is not only a function of z, but can also be function of kinematics and polarization and so on. Okay, but let's see how this can be done. So how to impose this scattering equations. So we want to find a formula that impose this scattering equation. You may say this is very, very simple, right? You just write down some integration over all the z's. This is like integration over the moduli space, where you put delta function of the scattering equations, or n of them. And then you put some integrand here, some I that depends on z and depends on other things, say polarization, kinematics and polarization and so on. So this will be one way to impose it, right? So for example, you want to say, oh, this will represent your young mu's partial amplitude, but I want this z to satisfy scattering equation. What do? I integrate over them on the support of scattering equation. These are the delta functions, right? So this will be the naive way to do it. You will claim that once I can find some rational function here, depends on z and others, this will give me some amplitude. But this is not really correct because of the redundancy we just mentioned, right? So you cannot integrate over all n variables on the support of all the n constraints because they are not independent. There are some redundancy to them. So let's now make this very precise. What is the measure? What is this way of impose the equations? Oh, I is just some. So this is a second step. So we split the problem into two steps. The first is you want to impose scattering equation, and the second is you want to find some integrand or this function. This is analog of this part. So you can call this guy like I. This Park Taylor with some f. So for different theories, you have a different I. This is theory dependent, right? But we want to argue that this part, at least this measure part, is theory independent. For any massless particle scattering, you should have this kinematic part. And now we want to make this problem. We want to solve this problem first. What is the specific form? What is the precise definition of this measure? And then we'll worry about this in the second part of today's lecture.
This typically is supposed to produce partial amplitude.
Any amplitude. So if here you put in Park Taylor, it may give you partial amplitude. If you dress it with color, it can give you full amplitude. Or if you write down something that doesn't have any color but depends on polarization tensor can give you gravity, but let's worry about it later. So now I'm going to tell you what is this precise form. So precise form is very simple. You just mod out all your redundancy, okay? So instead of writing this, you write down A from 1 to N, A different from three guys, I, J, and K. So in the previous case, we choose I, J, K to be 1, 2, 3, D, Z, A. But you need to remember that you want to put a Fadiev Popov Jacobian there, the determinant there, to compensate the fact that you strip off three variables. I'll explain that in a second. And instead of writing down this, I also can write the equations with only with n minus three of them. I can eliminate three equations, so I can write this, where this is a product of only n minus three equations, just like here, it's a product of n minus three integrals, dz's. And I compensate by the same Jacobian. What is this Jacobian? It's very simple. It's just the Van der Mond of the, so let me write it here. This is simply the determinant of this null vector that I introduced there. It's null vector 1 or z square. So this is a Van der Mond matrix. Zi, Zj, Zk. You can easily show that by eliminating three variables or three equations, this is exactly what you pick up as a Jacobian. Zi square, Zj square, Zk square. You compute it, it's just Zij, Zjk, and Zki. Well, this is simply the difference of these, okay? So all I'm saying is that we don't want this, but instead we want this reduced measure and delta function with something composite. And I'll just take the product of them and call them d mu. This is the measure we're gonna use. The measure of integrating over n minus three variables with n minus three equations. And also as an exercise, I want you to show that this d mu is actually permutation invariant. It doesn't depend on what ij, k, or rst you choose. So you can choose to eliminate any three variables, any three equations. These two sets doesn't have to be the same. As long as you compensate with this Jacobian, the whole thing, this whole d mu n as a product of them, is permutation invariant. Okay. So this is our measure, and let me further write it down as a identity. So what does it mean to really write down this this d mu n with some theory dependent integrand of z and other variables? It's not really an integral, as you've already, I hope you already understand that. It looks like an integral, but it's, all the integrations are localized. All the integrals are localized by this delta function, right? So this is actually a summation of all the solutions. Z belong to the set of all the solutions. And I told you there are actually n minus three factorial of them. So you're summing over n minus three factorial solutions. For each of them, you evaluate your I on that solution. So let's call it Z star, the solutions, n minus three factorial of them. And you also pick up a Jacobian, right, by doing a localized integral like this with delta function inside here. So with this delta function. And this Jacobian is exactly determinant prime of this derivative matrix, dA over dZB as a matrix. So this is what we do in practice. So if I give you a theory, you want to find its amplitude for some theory. Your job is to find the integrand that depends on Z and some information like wave function of these particles in the theories. And you want to do this localized integral. You want to impose that Z's are solutions to scattering equation, right? And what you do in practice is you solve the equations. You find n minus three factorial solutions. You sum over them, where the sum end is given by your integrand evaluated on the solution and also a Jacobian. So what is this Jacobian? Let me just further tell you. I mean, it's already written here, but let me just write it down. There's this matrix, DEA the derivative matrix of scattering equation with the variables. It's given by, so let me put a minus sign. It's given by SAB over ZAB squared, if A different from B, And if A is the same as B, if you do the derivative of DEA with DZA, then it's the sum of C different from A, SAC, ZAC square. Okay, so this is the matrix. It's a n by n matrix with off diagonal entries like this, and diagonal entry is just the sum of the column or row. And you don't take its determinant. You only take it and reduce the determinant because you eliminate three column and row. You eliminate three equations and three variables. So the determinant prime of this matrix is actually the determinant of the matrix that you first delete three column ijk, and then you delete three rows rst, and then you compensate by this for the f power of Jacobian. So this is the definition of this Jacobian determinant prime. Yeah, all these are just to let you know that there is this precise definition of imposing the equations, n minus three equation for n minus three variables, which in practice, actually you can really just do it like this. I give you the 5-point equation, you solve, you find two solutions, and you compute this Jacobian, you do it, you will find the amplitude. Okay, so the second part of our lecture is really to find the form of this. But here I just give you all these details of computing in a theory independent way, all the details of computing amplitude using scattering equations. Yes.
Sorry, when you said you delete rows to go from det die e
die yeah,
to
yeah.
Det prime.
Yeah.
What rows and columns?
Yes. So this matrix is built up from this matrix has column label given by B and the row label given by A. And since I only have all the variables without ijk, it means from this matrix, I need to delete ijk columns. And I only have equations without RST, so I need to delete those columns,
so those
right?
Are just whatever ijk and RST,
you choose to eliminate. And this gives you an n-3 by n-3 matrix that you compute its determinant. And now, after doing that, you put this this Vandermon matrices because of the deletion. And this is your Jacobian. And this equation is exactly equivalent to this definition, right? So it's just saying that I just want to write them in a permutation invariant way. That's why I write it this way. In practice, I can just say, okay, let's fix Z1, Z2, Z3 to be this. Let's eliminate E1, E2, and E3. And then you can just write down the formula with only n-3 variable and n-3. Equations, and we evaluate the determinant as you want. Okay. So all this is just giving you the idea that the set of equation we found is indeed very powerful for describing massless particle scattering, and it seems to be theory independent, that you can find a precise way of imposing them and so on. But now, what are this integrand that you want to find to give you the amplitude? So let's just sharpen a little bit our statement here. Yes. So this statement here, we just said from the lesson from yesterday, we said that we want a function of Z's where Z satisfies scattering equation, and it has a part that looks like a Park-Taylor with certain ordering and some permutation invariant function of Z, doesn't depend on permutation. We want this to be our Yang-Mills amplitude, because this is the way we see to satisfy these identities that we know Yang-Mills amplitude will generally satisfy. So this is our first statement. We expect that, say, the partial amplitude of A Yang-Mills with, let's just pick a canonical ordering. It's just the easiest to write down. We expect them to be exactly this. Just write it like this. Okay, so this I call it the left integrand. This is the right integrand, right? So this is a statement from yesterday's lesson, but now we make it very sharp. Because yesterday we just say, okay, we want this Z to satisfy scattering equations, but we didn't know how to impose that. Now I've taught you how to impose that. You just put a measure here of M minus three variables localized by M minus three equations, and you choose some permutation invariant object. This is my F, but now I call it I write. I will explain why I call it this way, and put a Park Taylor here, right? So we already see that this will satisfy U1 and BCJ. Because this guy is permutation invariant. We want to find something permutation invariant here. And this will do the job. Okay. And let me explain why I call it I left and I right. Because something I explained here is that there is some SL2C transformation property of your Z's and of your scattering equations. So actually, I think this is plus two. Yeah, this should be plus two. Then you put it in the delta function, it becomes minus two. So actually, I can write down this. The measure under this transformation goes to gamma plus delta ZA minus four of the measure. So this is also an exercise if you want to check this. And the measure transform like this, yeah.
So the IR that you've written there,
mm-hmm.
is
the F.
FO.
Yes.
Oh, it's just the FO without the
It's just the F, and this is a Park Taylor, yeah. So because this transformation, what we expect for the integrand is that it should transform inversely to make the whole formula SL2C invariant, right? So we expect this I, which is I left times I right in general. So in all the cases we found that actually there's a factorization of this integrand, but it doesn't really matter. So we want this I integrand to transform in the inverse way. To the fourth of IN. Okay? So this is just the requirement of SL2C that your measure transform this way, so your integrand has to transform this way. What does it mean? This SL2C property can be easily said in words because it requires that I is only a function of such differences of Z, ZM and ZJ. And also it tells you that it should have this weight is telling you that it should have the weight of each part, each label to the fourth in the denominator, if you check it. So for example, this Park Taylor formula that we just write down, for any ordering, this guy under SL2C transformation just goes to square of this gamma plus delta ZA square of the same object. So in some sense, this Park Taylor is half integrand. Because it only transforms under SL2C with weight two, with weight minus two if you want, because it's in the denominator. And all you want is something with weight minus four. So that's why you need an I right, which has the same weight as this Park Taylor, but now it's some permutation invariant object. And it also makes sense, right? You cannot expect Young mu sum to just be given by this part. Although it will give you BCJ and KK, it doesn't even tell you how to depend on polarization and so on, because this part, this whole measure and so on only depends on the momentum, the kinematics. It doesn't have a dependence on polarization. So you really need to find the object that gives you the dependence on polarization and also give you the correct SL2C weight. Okay, so this is a general idea that will proceed. But now you also have a simpler theory that we, yes.
What is contained inside K and IR?
Oh, yes. This is the momenta, k1 to kn.
But isn't it already contained inside Z?
Very good. So in general, this Z just encode the propagator property of the things. But your numerator, from Feynman diagram, your numerator not only depend on epsilon dot epsilon, but it can also depend on epsilon dot k and k dot k. So there are actually, in general, this integrand will have additional dependence on, explicit dependence on k, in addition to those that implicitly through the Zs. So
can't you just reconstruct every single k from Z because isn't k equal to lambda tilde?
But lambda, no, that's only in 4D. So in 4D you can write lambda tilde in terms of Z, but here there are explicit dependence on K in addition to the dependence on Z as the solutions. But now I give you the simplest example where this guy is actually also only dependent on Z. You may be able to already guess what that theory is. It's a bi-adjoint scalar that I introduced in the first lecture. Bi-adjoint phi cube theory. This phi cube theory that has a gauge group UN, I mean, a color or flavor group UN cross UN tilde, and it has a phi cubic interaction with two structure constants, if you remember that. And this statement also appeared there that the partial amplitude of that theory has to satisfy U1 BCJ, so it should have Park Taylor in it, right, as we discussed yesterday. But now, actually, this theory has a double partial amplitude. If you remember, it has some double partial amplitude that depends on two ordering, because you can do the color decomposition with U and with U and tilde. And from our discussion yesterday, to make double partial amplitude for both ordering to satisfy U1 and BCJ, actually you want to put two copies of Park Taylor for this guy. One Park Taylor for this ordering, one Park Taylor for this ordering. So this actually does the job. In this special case of, in this case of bi-adjoint phi Q, your IR is again an I left. So let's just call this guy. I just give you the shorthand notation that it's 1, 2, 3 to n. Okay. So now let me write down the first theorem in our construction, which is the endpoint double partial amplitude is simply given by scattering equation with the simplest possible integrand, which is 2 Park Taylor with the given ordering. This is 1 Park Taylor, and this is the second one. A lot of, so this is your I left, and this is your I right. Indeed, here everything only depends on Z. Right? It doesn't depend on additional on K, and also there's no epsilon in it. It's a scalar theory. So this is our first statement. It is proven by study on both sides what's the poles and residues of this function. So let me just remind you what is this guy. This double partial amplitude is the sum of all cubic diagrams, tree diagrams, cubic diagrams that respect alpha ordering and beta ordering. And for each diagram, you put all its propagator here. It's just the propagator without any numerator, right? It's just the simplest skeleton theory. So in other words, we found a formula in terms of scattering equation that has 2 Park Taylors in it. So that's why it can satisfy U1 and BCJ for each copy. We found such a formula to express any cubic diagram, sum of certain cubic diagram in this bi-adjoint phi cube theory. So this is actually the skeleton for all formulas we'll discuss later. So in principle, we're done, because all the tree amplitude can be written as expansion in terms of this cubic diagram with certain numerator. Since we found each cubic diagram has some scattering equation formula like this, we're done, right? So this is a proof that any tree amplitude can be expressed in terms of this this type of formula. Although it doesn't buy you anything, because it's like doing Feynman diagram. You need to work out what's the numerator factor of this propagator, and it's very, very in general it doesn't simplify anything. It's still very complicated. So our job later is to find, say, for Young Mills and for gravity, what are other ways that we can determine this directly without expanding them into cubic diagram and so on, right? But here I just want to emphasize again that before I go to Young Mills or gravity, this is the first example we discussed here. Okay, so you have scattering equation measure. So this is precisely given here as the integration over Z and as the imposing scattering equation. And then you just put 2 copies of Park Taylor, and this will give you all the cubic diagram in that respects both ordering. So if you remember, I give you some exercise on this bi-adjoint scalar for 4 point or 5 point. You can actually check that this formula will give you the thing if you evaluate them like this. Okay. So before I go to the Young Mills case, which is the last thing I discussed today, any questions for the equations or for this simplest example? Yes.
If I understand correctly, this idea
idea here is that we found a special case where these massless scattering operations are satisfied, and now we're going to generalize that and say that this should be true for any massless scattering.
Yes.
Is there any justification for that, or is this just a conjecture?
So one justification is that we see this equation, in addition to those special solutions, any solution of the equation is relating. So this moduli space of n puncture spheres is exactly describing the singularity structure of your amplitude, which is the only important thing for your massless scattering at tree level. So this is a justification that this equation should be underlying any massless scattering. Of course, the key property is that if you can find some integrand to describe exactly the theory you want. For example, if I give you a random theory with any coupling, this integrand can be very, very complicated. So although we can do it in general for any cubic diagram, it doesn't mean it's useful for computing things. So the next question, which will go in the next step, is what are those theories that have very simple integrand? And I give you half the answer for Yang-Mills. It must contain a partitor. But what is this part that depends on polarization and so on? But the equations themselves are universal. So yeah, that's something I want to emphasize. Yes. Okay, so what's the way to determine this I write for Yang-Mills case? That'll be the thing we do the next. Actually the yes.
I think there's something I'm confused about.
Yes.
So in general, if we have some process of trying to calculate the amplitude for the Z's are inputs, the things that we know because they're related to momentum. At least in four dimensions. But you were integrating over them.
So these are not inputs. The K, the SABs are inputs, right? This you agree?
Yes.
And in four dimension, this is probably, it's a bad idea to talk about spinor helicity, I guess, that these are very special solutions. So I told you, in general, there are n minus three factorial solutions. Mm-hmm. And these are only two of them. I mean, for 4-point, they are identified. MHV is MHV bar, so there's only one. But in general, these are only a very small subset of all the solutions you find. And in higher than 4D, they don't exist, right? Because you don't have spinor language and so on. So these are not inputs. These are these are functions that depend on SAB, but they are in general very complicated dependence on that. So by integrating over them, we're not really integrating over them at all. We are just, where is it? What we do is we just summing over all the solutions, right? So it's very important that this is integration, but they are all localized by the scattering equation. So what you have is the data that you have SAB. From there, you solve for all the Zs. And now you want to plug in the solution for this to give you amplitudes. So the amplitude, the formula of the amplitude depends on Z, which means it depends on S in the end. And also you need to put in some additional dependence on K and epsilon. If it's scalar, you don't need it. If it's gluon and graviton, you need this dependence additionally, right? Okay. So now it's just really the case that I want to find a simple function of Z and K and epsilon. That gives me all the n gluon scattering in Yang-Mills. And I already used one property, which is this BCJ and the U1 identity to tell me that I need this part that's only depend on Z, because this will give me naturally the, this together with the fact that Z satisfies scattering equation will give me BCJ, right? Do you agree? Now I want this, which I know it must be permutation invariant. It must transform under SL2C like half the integrand. And now I also need some other principle to tell me how to find this guy. And this principle turns out to be gauge invariance. So something we haven't used. As I said from the beginning, it's very, so at Feynman diagram level, each Feynman diagram depends on the gauge redundancies in it. And in the end, after you sum over them, they cancel. So here we really want to find a way that we can see the gauge invariance of the amplitude directly at level of this function. So what is the thing we want to find? We want to impose that the Yang-Mills amplitude, if you shift any epsilon by something proportional to its momentum, it should be invariant, right? So we want to find the formula that manifests this property. We already found half of the formula that manifests the BCG, and so now we want this gauge invariance. And let me tell you how to do that in a, let me directly give you the answer that what is the function you're looking for. So this, so I left this determinant, so I only need to find what is I right. That depends on Z, K, and epsilon. That will give you this property. And I right turns out to be constructed from a matrix. This is the only way we know how to make gauge invariance manifest by consider first a matrix, which is a 2n by 2n matrix that has four blocks. Each of them is an n by n matrix that I'll specify now. So the A part of the matrix is very simple. It's just a similar to what you have in scattering equation. Each entry of the matrix is this ka dot kb over za minus zb. If a different from b, so off diagonal term. If a is the same as b, you just take it to be zero. Okay, so this is the a part. Let me just give you a little bit, some idea what this a part look like. So you have zero for the diagonal term, and then this term will be k1 dot k2, okay, over z1 minus z2. This is the first entry of your non-trivial entry of your A matrix. And then you have a k1 dot k3, z1 minus z3. To the last one is k1 dot kn, z1 minus zn. And it's an anti-symmetric matrix. So here you have similar things. The minus this guy here and minus this guy here and so on, okay? Yeah, let me just make it smaller. So this is the A part, the upper left part of your matrix, which has this dependence on only depends on k dot k and z, okay? So now what is the B part? B part turns out to be very similar, but now it only depends on epsilon dot epsilon. Again, it's an anti-symmetric matrix. If you have off-diagonal term, it's epsilon A dot epsilon B over ZA minus ZB. If you have diagonal term, it's zero. So let's also write it down. So this is the B part, the lower right part, which has this, say, this term is epsilon 1 dot epsilon 2, Z1 minus Z2, epsilon 1 dot epsilon 3, z1 minus z3, all the way to epsilon 1 dot epsilon n, z1 minus zn, okay? So now the interesting thing is that there are this C part, and as I should said from the beginning, this is an anti-symmetric matrix, 2n by 2n anti-symmetric matrix. So already I made this A and B part manifestly anti-symmetric, so C can be anything, but this part has to be its transpose with a minus sign, right, to make it anti-symmetric. So what is the C matrix? You probably can guess it now, because this part depends on k dot k, this depends on epsilon dot epsilon, so you need also epsilon dot k, right? So the C matrix is, should I write it? Yes, so CAB, let me write it here, CAB is simply epsilon a dot kb over za minus zb, if a different from b. However, if a is the same as b, it's more complicated. It's the sum of the rest. C different from a. So this is already looks familiar if you look at that matrix I write down for the, if you look at here. So you also see something like that. The diagonal term of a matrix is the sum of the column or row. So here is another example of something like that, your C matrix. Because its diagonal term doesn't have to be zero now. The diagonal term of C is not the diagonal of your big matrix. So let me just write it down here. This is C11, C22, all the way to CNN of your diagonal term of this form. And this is simply epsilon 1 dot K2, Z1 minus Z2, epsilon 1 dot K3, Z1 minus Z3, all the way to epsilon 1 dot Kn, Z1 minus Zn. And this part is the transpose of that with a minus sign, okay? So you can easily write it down as minus C11 minus C22 minus Cnn. And this line, this row is actually this row. So it's actually K1 dot epsilon 2. K1 dot epsilon 3. K1 dot epsilon n. Okay? So this is the matrix we want to consider. It looks very complicated, but it's really a simple four block of n by n matrices, depends on k dot k, epsilon dot epsilon, and epsilon dot k. Where this C part is something I want to emphasize because the diagonal piece of the C part is the minus the sum of the rest. So why do we consider this matrix? Because this matrix is a way to, actually, if you ask a string theorist, it will tell you that this matrix naturally appear if you consider the correlation function of n gluon vertex operators. But for us, if you only care about field theory amplitude, the key property of this matrix is that it realizes this gauging invariance in the most manifest way if you impose the Z satisfied scattering equation. Let's see why that's the case, okay? So this matrix is something we want to put in this IR, and we want this IR to satisfy this property that whenever I replace, say for example, I replace epsilon 1 by K1 in my amplitude, I want the amplitude to vanish. That's the statement of gauging invariance, right? So why is this matrix, why would this matrix do the job? Let's just do this epsilon 1 replace to K1 business explicitly on the matrix. So you see, epsilon 1 is here everywhere. So let's replace it by K1. Let me just not erase that, but really replace it. Let's replace it by K1. So it becomes K1 dot K2. This numerator becomes K1 dot K2. This becomes K1 dot K3. And the last one becomes K1 dot Kn, okay? And this becomes K1 dot epsilon 2. Remember, now I'm replacing this epsilon 1 by K1 in the whole matrix. And it only appear mostly appear here. So K1 dot epsilon 3 all the way to this one. That's K1 dot epsilon n, right? This is everything? No, it's not everything because there's also C11 that depend on epsilon 1. So what is C11 when I replace epsilon 1 by K1? It's simply K1 dot KB. Z1 minus ZB, we are summing over B from 2 to N, right? Agree? Because C11 was given by epsilon 1 dot KB over this. Now I replace epsilon 1 by K1. And similarly here, it's replaced by K1 dot KB over Z1 minus ZB, B from 2 to N. So this is the result of replacing epsilon 1 by K1 for the whole matrix. And notice something very special happened now, that this column, this row of the n plus one row becomes exactly the same as the first row. So this is the same like that, this is the same, and similarly here. And very importantly, this is zero, this diagonal of C is zero, because your Z satisfies scattering equation. So this is exactly this E1, this first equation. So that means this is zero just like this, and this is zero just like that. So this row and this row become exact same. Similarly, this column and this column. I didn't write it down, but you can check that. So the matrix become more singular. You know, if the matrix before was non-singular, now it's singular. So that's something very important that happened. So if we now take the determinant of some Fafian, yeah, because it's an anti-symmetric matrix, so you can actually take its Fafian, which is the square root of the determinant. Yeah, well, I'll explain later. But if you take some function of this matrix to make it the integrand you need, before it was non-zero, after this replacement, it will become zero. So this is why we choose it to describe the dependence on polarization and so on for Young Mills amplitude. And also later for gravity amplitude, we will need this matrix. So it's basically the simple property that gauge invariance of this object on the support of scattering equation are made manifest. That's why we would need this matrix, okay? So what is precisely the integrand we consider here? So this is the last thing I'll discuss.
Why is this replacement vanished by the
inverse? Oh, because this is the linearized version, right? So if you shift your polarization by something like that, because your amplitude in the end is linear in this guy. In every epsilon. So every epsilon, if you shift it by something proportional to its momentum, the amplitude should be invariant. That is equivalent to say if you replace it by K1, I mean that implies if you replace it by K1, it should vanish. The additional piece of your shift should vanish because it's linear in every epsilon. Yes.
Should we be thinking of some symplectic structure here? Is that what is causing this?
Actually, I think it's directly coming from the, so in the end, the answer is given by Fafing of this matrix, which is actually the Grassmann integral of your superstring correlations. So this structure you see with antisymmetry and so on is directly related to the fact that you have world tree supersymmetry and so on. I don't know if that answers your question. I don't see any symplectic structure here. That's the interpretation I have. So this guy, this Fafing of this guy is actually the correlator of n gluon vertex operators. Yes.
And does this need supersymmetry to go through, or like if it is a superstring, or will this give us amplitude, Young-Mills amplitude?
Because it's tree level, so they're equivalent. Yeah. At loop level, you would need supersymmetry for now to get representations of loop amplitudes. So okay, let's just write down precisely what is this IR for Young Mills. It's the Fafing of this guy. So Fafing is just it's just like determinant, but now you have a anti-symmetric matrix, so your determinant is a perfect square. And why don't we take the determinant? You will see next lecture that the determinant actually gives you gravity. So determinant is too much. It's taking two copy of the Fafing, because if you start to take the determinant of this matrix, you will find that it's not linear in epsilon, in every epsilon, it's quadratic in them. So that's two copy of polarization for each particle. So that's why you need to take the square root of the determinant to make it linear in every polarization vector. And also you can see if you want to have the correct SL2C property like this, if you take determinants too many, it's already the whole integrand, it's not half the integrand. So you need to take the Fafing, okay? So essentially, we want to make the statement that I write is just the I write of Young Mills, which depend on Z, epsilon, and K, is simply this Fafing of this psi matrix that depends on Z, epsilon, and K, right? So it's the square root of the determinant that's multilinear in all the epsilon and so on. But this is wrong because this gives you zero actually. So I hope you notice that the matrix actually has some null vector. So if you take the sum of the first row of the whole matrix, this part sum up to zero because of scattering equation, okay? And this part sum to zero by construction. This guy is the minus the sum of the rest. So the matrix actually has not only one, but two such null vectors. That means we need to define again, reduce the determinant or reduce the Fafing like we did before. And this is exactly the reflection of world sheet supersymmetry if you connect it with the superstring correlator. But that we won't come into there. So let me just point out that the matrix has two null vector. So if you take the take the sum or take them multiplied by z1 to zn, this is zero. That means you need to define a reduced matrix, just like before. We've already got familiar with this. We need a matrix that we can delete i's and j's column and rows. And now we compute its Pfaffian, and we adjust with the Jacobian. Now the Jacobian is a little bit funny. It has this factor that's expected. You deleted them, you want to adjust them, but it also has a sign because you are doing a Pfaffian. I mean, I think you can. Just a minus one to this. So we call this guy the reduced Pfaffian of this matrix. Now everything is perfect because, first of all, just like what we proved before, I left as an exercise before. For the reduced Pfaffian, it's like the reduced determinant that is permutation invariant. So it doesn't really depend on which column and row you delete. As long as you address it with this guy, everything is fine. And it's still multilinear in all the epsilon because you didn't delete anything with epsilon. You only delete things with k. So this ij, it goes from 1 to n. It doesn't concern the column and row starting n plus 1 to 2n. That's the epsilon part. And now it's non-zero, right? So it's a permutation invariant object that is multilinear in all the epsilon, and it has the correct mass dimension if you want to check. And it's now it's non-zero. And if you replace epsilon by k, it becomes zero. Okay, so before that statement is that more precise statement is that this replacement makes a matrix more singular. Okay, so the thing you need here is to reduce the Pfaffian. That will give you all the dependence on polarization and so on. And now if you do this IR, replace epsilon by k, you get zero, precisely because of our argument there. So the conclusion is the following, that so this Young Mills amplitude in the end is given by this Park Taylor. The partial amplitude of Young Mills is given by Park Taylor times this permutation invariant object that depends on everything. Okay, so this is our final formula for the gluon scattering in any dimension, and you see here that this is for phi cube. And tomorrow, I mean, I can tell you now that if you replace this by another copy of Pfaffian, in other words, if you get a reduced determinant, you get the amplitude for the gravity. But we'll discuss that tomorrow, and also some relations among all these theories. So I guess I'll stop here, and let me know if you have more questions. Yeah, that's a very good question. So this is basically, so in the end, what you want to prove that this function, as after you sum it over all the solutions, it has all the poles of a Young-Mills tree amplitude, and on each physical pole, it has the correct factorization. So that's the rigorous proof that you can, this formula is correct for all the amplitude. Yeah, and then, exactly. So how do you come to this choice of this matrix? It's actually, it's not our original construction, but later we realized the uniqueness is basically given by string theory. So this object you need here is exactly the n gluon. After you strip off the alpha prime dependence, this guy is exactly the correlator of n gluon vertex operators. So that gives you uniquely this guy. But here I want to explain that even if you didn't know about string theory, you want to construct such a matrix. I mean, I'll give you the challenge that you want to construct a function that has this SL2C property, permutation invariant, and gauge invariant. I don't have a proof for uniqueness, but I think it's very difficult to come up with an alternative one. It'd be very nice if you can come up with a uniqueness proof that saying that there's something very special about Young Mills. You know, it's so. For example, if you now want to have a theory that has higher derivative coupling, like F cube or something, this will need to be modified. So there's something very special about Young Mills that this is unique. Yeah. Also for gravity. So you take the determinant of this matrix, it gives you Einstein gravity, but it doesn't really give you higher derivative couplings and so on. So there's some uniqueness about Young Mills and gravity in the classes of all these amplitudes. Yes.
How can you see that this scales appropriately in your S?
Good. S- good. S- So if you look at this matrix, every column and row, so the first row or first column under the SL2C transformation, it picks up this gamma plus delta Z1, for example, the first one, square, actually. So if you take the determinant, you find it's actually to the fourth.
Sorry, why square?
Because, oh, sorry, each one is just one power. But
right.
you have here, you have a column that has Z1 everywhere, and also here, you have a row.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So that's why it's a 2n by 2n matrix whose determinant will directly give you to the fourth, but whose Fafian, which is square root, will give you only square. Yeah. So in some sense, the Fafian of this matrix is like Park-Taylor, because it has only, say, Z1 only appear twice in the denominator, Z2 appear twice in the denominator, and so on. But if you take determinant, it appear four times, which is too many. Yes.
Could you remind us why that thing needs to scale? Why it needs to scale up the fourth power?
Yes, very good. So the measure that I introduced here, the measure I introduced somewhere, has this transformation property that, so okay, dZa transform, this is also something you can trivially show, right? Each dZa transform like this, minus two. Damn right. And each delta Ea also transform minus two, okay? So the whole thing, the whole measure, d mu, transform to minus four for all the particles. Although you delete three, you compensate by the Jacobi. So that means under SL2C transformation, your integrand, your I, has to transform like plus four to cancel this, such that the formula makes sense, because the formula has to be invariant under SL2C. Massive particles.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll come to it tomorrow, which is, we only know one way to generate it. We only know one kind of trivial way to see that it applies to massive particle, because it works in any dimension. Since it works in any dimension, the formula naturally apply to the massive theories if you do the Clausius-Klein reduction. But for other theories with masses, we still don't know how to, because for other theories in general with massive particles, it will not talk to this moduli space of Riemann sphere naturally. So at the moment, there's only one way to describe amplitudes. Say, for example, if you want to see the Yamil's theory on the Coulomb branch or supersymmetric Yamil theory on Coulomb branch in 4D, you can write down all this formula in 6D, and you do the reduction, it will give you the amplitude with masses. But that's the only way. It's still using the massless amplitude, but in higher dimension. Yes.
You really need this way so that you get a new symmetry. But compared to original theory, where does this new symmetry hide?
It's a very good point that we still don't know how to identify why this massless particle, field theory with massless particle, has a hidden CFT or hidden sphere to describe it. So some people, there are other contexts, some people associate this sphere with the algebra of the softer limit and so on. So they conjecture there's a CFT for, at least in 4D, the CFT for 4D scattering amplitude because there's softer behavior and so on. This will also come tomorrow or Friday, but it's still open question. So we know that there is this sphere for tree-level amplitude in string theory, but not for, in general, not for field theory, because when you take the field theory limit, you recover Feynman diagram. You lost this sphere. So there's this construction, so-called ambitwister string, that I won't have time to discuss, which is telling you that all this field theory amplitude, at least at tree level, now also some generalization to loop level, is coming from correlator of a specific string theory. So there is string theory for computing field theory amplitude. There, everything from the beginning is with this CFT correlator. Yeah, at tree level it's equivalent, so we don't need any supersymmetry. But at loop level, for example, this ambitwister string will strongly depend on supersymmetry. So in that construction, at loop level, they know how to do, at one loop level, they know how to do supergravity, but not Einstein gravity, for example.
Oh, you mean at loop level, you
there with a supersymmetry? So it depends on how you interpret it. If you interpret all this as some ambitwister string, the only way to we know how to go to loop level is still with supersymmetry. But if you view it as a very general construction, then I don't have an answer why we need this Riemann sphere and higher genus Riemann surfaces. But in principle, you can construct a non-supersymmetric loop integrand using loop amplitude using this. Yes.
Perfect. Well,
thank you.